All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Robert N. Davis, Chief Judge, presiding. All those with business before this court, draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I have a brief announcement before I call the case. We will be immediately convening a ceremonial session after this oral argument for the court in recognition of its 30th anniversary at the creation and beginning of the court. We will be celebrating throughout the next 12 months with a large ceremony in the fall of 2019. So those of you who would like to stay, I'd invite you to do so. It should be interesting and fun, and we will be recording it for our historical purposes. That's all I had on that one. I'm Chief Judge Davis. To my right is Judge Sholin, Bartley, Allen, and Toth. To my left is Judges Peach, Greenberg, Meredith, and Foudy. We're here today in the matter of Morgan against Wilkie, docket number 17-0098. To consider, among other things, whether the Board of Veterans' Appeals erred by not referring Mr. Morgan's service-connected hearing loss for extra scheduler consideration. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
For the appellant, Zachary Stoltz, is arguing with me at counsel's table, Amy Odom from the law firm Chisholm
Kilpatrick. Great. Welcome. Welcome. Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present your respective arguments. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
10 minutes, if I may, Your Honor.
Very well. Thank you. Mr. Stoltz, you may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Davis, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The court issued an order in which it asked five questions and had some issues to discuss. I'd like to start there. The framework laid out in Thun v. Peek remains viable. The test has been clarified by three precedent cases handed down after the first oral argument in this case, King, Peterman, and Spellers. Each case helps to clarify that test. King instructs that under Thun, step one, an adjudicator compared the symptoms and severity of a disability against what is contemplated in the relevant diagnostic code. It affirmed Doucette's distinction that the symptoms covered by the diagnostic code are audiological in nature. Peterman explained that the severity of symptoms should also be compared against the relative diagnostic code. Both cases clarify that there are two components to Thun step one. The first component compares symptoms, and the symptoms not the rating criteria provide a basis for possible referral. The first component also compares severity to symptoms possibly already covered by the diagnostic code. It is in the second step that an adjudicator addresses the effects on a veteran's employment. Importantly, in both steps, the adjudicator must consider severity. Assessing the adequacy of the rating criteria under element one rests in part on determining whether a service-connected disability affects employment in ways not contemplated by the rating schedule. That is a quote from Thun.
Mr. Stoltz, could I ask, does the amended regulation have any impact on the analytical model that you indicate in Thun?
The analytical model, no, Your Honor. The clarification or the regulation change has addressed in the parties after the first oral argument. We both submitted supplemental memoranda of law, which seems to indicate that we agree that the only thing that has really changed is no combined effects analysis needs to be done anymore in accordance with the Johnson case, and the fact that referral doesn't necessarily have to happen, that an adjudicator at the board or regional office level can make the determination in the first instance. So those, but the analysis under Thun, King, Peterman, Doucette, Mala, et al. Remains viable.
Now, I noticed that you characterized step one of Thun as comparing the symptoms in the criteria to the symptoms that the veteran has. Where, if at all, does functional effects come into that analysis?
Yes, functional effects, leading back, I believe, to the Martinet case, especially in the hearing loss context, it fits into step one. Functional effects, as I read the case, or as we read the case law, is a way for an examiner or for the evidence of record to illuminate or to help adjudicate under step one. So the functional effects fall under that category. They can also permeate a little bit the step two, because the functional effects may be effects on employment, which would be done step two. So it seems that functional effects are a way to help adjudicators or to help adjudicators make the Thun analysis under steps one and two.
And one of your arguments, I believe, in this case was that the veteran had some effects of hearing loss that would affect his ability to drive or be in traffic safely.
Yes, Your Honor.
So is that the kind of symptom, because we did start out with symptoms here whenever you were talking, is that the kind of symptom that should be contemplated under 3.321?
It's a symptom and it's a severity issue. Because it, and this is part of perhaps some of the confusion, that happens in extrascheduler analysis, is that it's kind of developed in this way where there are these blinders on as to Thun step one, that you only kind of look at symptoms and severity. It's broader than that, and because the functional effects illuminate step one, I would say, Your Honor, that it does go under step one, but it also kind of goes under step two, which the siloing off effect that kind of happened after the Yancey case, where step one and step two became these very separate steps that one has to go through, isn't necessarily practical, because severity is a component of Thun's step one and two. And so it's hard to just wall off what the functional effects could be, even if it's under step one or step two. I hope I'm making some sense there, but the answer to Your Honor's question is it goes under signs and symptoms.
Uh-huh. And so it is so a traffic safety or driving safety impact. Here I'm bringing in another word, impact, mm-hmm. instead of effect.
Yes, Your Honor.
That is the kind of thing that you believe should be considered under 3.321.
Yes.
And I note that 4.21, which is titled, 38 CFR 4.21, is titled Application of Rating Schedule. Oops, no, not 4.21. Actually, I think it's 4.10. Is titled Functional Impairment. And that talks about functional effects, essentially, I think. And it says that the basis of disability evals is the ability of the body as a whole to function under the ordinary conditions of daily life, including employment. And then it goes further and says, this imposes upon the medical examiner the responsibility of furnishing, in addition to etiological, anatomical, pathological, laboratory, and prognostic data required for ordinary medical classification, full description of the effects of a disability upon the person's ordinary activity. Now, that's called functional impairment, and then it talks about essentially functional effects. So does the inclusion of functional impairment and potentially functional effects in 4.10 mean that those are the kinds of things that should be considered in the actual rating, the usual schedule for rating disabilities, and not in the not kind of corralled in the extra scheduler environment?
No, I think it can do both. Because no matter what happens in an adjudication, the rating officer or the board hearing officer or whomever is going to have to discuss the rating criteria found in the scheduler criteria. And so 4.10 informs both analyses. Functional effects can go, and I think that the sliding scale that the court is kind of developing, the Spellers case kind of discusses the other side of times when the extra scheduler analysis isn't going to work because the diagnostic codes may be broad. Whereas if you're in the hearing loss realm, which we are today, the scheduler criteria don't really contemplate the functional effects. And so I think 4.10, Your Honor, I would submit 4.10, Your Honor, covers both scenarios. And that is what the examiners should be doing. In a perfect world, the examiners would talk about the functional effects so that then the adjudicator could determine what falls under diagnostic criteria and what falls under extra scheduler criteria.
So do you concede that there are diagnostic codes that basically we should just take off the top and say extra scheduler isn't going to work in this context, like maybe range of motion?
No. I don't think they should be taken off the top. They should just be chopped out. I think that it is still, or I would submit that it is still an analysis that should best be done by the first adjudicators, the regional office and the board. It may very well be that the board or the regional office or the director or whomever determines that diagnostic code that diagnostic code is such that an extra scheduler evaluation doesn't do anything for the veteran. But I still think the analysis should be done, Your Honor. I don't know that there should be a black letter rule that, you know, psychiatric conditions, because they have more of a broad diagnostic criteria, are just taken off. You can never get an extra scheduler rating for that. Frankly, after Spellers, it could be harder, but there are scenarios in which the diagnostic criteria would not cover a veteran's individual condition. And the idea behind 3.321 is, after all, the broad concept of according justice. And so at the very least, even if an extra scheduler rating is not awarded, the analysis should be done if it's raised by the record.
There's been some criticism that 3.321 is supposed to be for exceptional circumstances, and that basically every board decision I pick up has an extra scheduler analysis in it. So how do you respond to the criticism that this exception has potentially swallowed the rule?
It doesn't. It's a regulation. It's in the it's in the Code of Federal Regulations, 3.8, right? So because it is there, the exception, the awards may be under exceptional conditions or unusual conditions, but the way that the analysis should be done should happen in cases in which these are raised. An exceptional could be read, and it seems to have been read in the case law, as being outside of the diagnostic criteria, and the entire idea is to take an individual veteran. And so it is not something that, even though it says exceptional or unusual and it looks like it should be a rare thing, it should be a rare award, doesn't mean that the analysis shouldn't be done and that a veteran shouldn't be given the chance at the many stops on the adjudication process in the VA system to have the opportunity to explain why his condition is not covered under the diagnostic code. And hearing loss is a perfect example of why that would be.
Mr. Stoltz, the Doucette panel struggled with the lack of a lot of specific symptomatology in the hearing loss area. In fact, Judge Sholin and I and Judge Lance were on that panel. And I remember, it's one of these cases that are recent enough where I actually do remember the case. I remember really trying to figure out what fell into the pool, if you will, of hearing loss related issues versus issues that may not be so directly connected to hearing loss. And I think the Doucette opinion gave examples of what, and the phrase I recall we struggled with was what was contemplated by the diagnostic code and the rating schedule. I think some examples included dizziness and ear pain and things that weren't necessarily directly part of the rating code. How do you or can you give us a guide that will maybe draw a bright line between things that are impacted by hearing loss versus things that are not a part of the scheduler or not contemplated by the scheduler rating?
Bright lines are hard to come by in extra scheduler analysis. So I don't, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I don't believe I can give you a bright line rule. But the court is going down the road of giving really good guidance to the board and to the regional offices. This is a judicial and regulatory test. It takes a little bit of time to flesh that out. And so while Doucette opened the door for a more Martinac before it and then Doucette opened the door for a more robust analysis of a diagnostic code that is unrealistically compensates hearing loss, in my opinion, once it opened the door, King came along and fleshed it out a bit more. And so the bright line examples in Doucette are very, very helpful. But again, the regulation is to accord justice. And so really this analysis, Your Honor, you know, we stand today in an appellate court. The analysis should be done first by the rating officers at the agency. And that would give Your Honors more of an opportunity to review and flesh out this test. So bright line is something I don't think can happen under 3.321, but the more cases that come, the more of an idea that we have about how this should be done at the agency level. And that's the problem in Mr. Morgan's case. You know, you have, like, as I started off, you have Doucette, King. Well, actually, you have King and Peterman over kind of on one side, and that was found to be error. And then you've got the other side where Spellers, there was no error in the extra schedule analysis. Doucette, there's no error in the extra scheduler analysis. But these guideposts are starting to be established. And in Mr. Morgan's case, it falls more on the side of the King and Peterman kind of scale because there are these things that are not, or these symptoms and severity that are not considered in the diagnostic criteria. And the board decision and hearing are so deficient here. The board, even at page, I think, 16 and 17 of the record, says, you have all these lay statements, and I'm paraphrasing, you have all these lay statements, but sorry, the way the diagnostic criteria works is you do pure tone threshold. They actually say, the board says that in this case, and then just gives a short analysis of extra scheduler. That's the problem. And the other problem, and I know it wasn't addressed in the five questions, but our first argument in this case was actually the hearing, not the board hearing, deficiency under Bryant, because Mr. Morgan starts to talk about these effects. He starts to talk about the fact that he believes it's more severe than the 10% awarded, and then the hearing just kind of ends. And we're not asking for a pre-adjudication of the case, but we are asking, and the reason that I'm saying this is because that's what's going to help the court adjudicate this, is more robust.
Sorry. If I can interrupt. With regard to severity in the hearing loss context, how would you assert the board conduct that analysis and the court review an analysis based on the grid that we get?
Well, the grid part of this was done fine.
Right.
There's no error in the grid part of this. That's kind of the beauty of hearing loss, is that part is easy.
Right, but that's all we got.
Right. And so that's all we've got. But then there's this regulation that stays out there that's a tough one that says to accord justice. And so easy, in hearing loss only. I'm not saying that this is always an easy job. It's far from it. And I respect what the board and regional offices have to do every day. It's tough. But at least for this one, it's pretty easy. The beeps in the audiometric testing spit out a result.
The human element of the adjudication is the part that's deficient here, because no one bothered to determine, even though there was evidence in the record, no one bothered to determine what this hearing loss was causing Mr. Morgan to actually go through on in his daily life, and then his effects on his employability.
And were those things that you're talking about, the effects on his daily life, were they in some way exceptional for someone who has hearing loss, or were they typical of the kinds of things that people with hearing loss would experience?
They're outside of the diagnostic criteria, so that's the test as far as my reading of the case law. The test is not, whoa, this is so beyond the pale that we need to do something. The test is it outside the diagnostic criteria? And here it is. Again, the sliding scale, a little bit more like King than like Doucette.
Could we get back to the evidence here in this case? Because I think you'd acknowledged earlier that the fund analysis doesn't take place unless the issue of extra schedule is either specifically raised or reasonably raised by the record. You're not contending that it was specifically raised below, are you?
We are not.
So in order to be reasonably raised by the record, is it the three documents that you pointed to in your briefs that we should be considering? It's record at 344, 436, and 750?
Yes, and again, the board's hearing, the hearing that was held,
right.
Which I think was in what you said.
So one of those documents that you talk about, record 436, which you point to for safety issues with driving, This is what that document reflects. In response to the question, does the veteran's tinnitus impact ordinary conditions of daily life, including ability to work? Mr. Morgan said that he has to have the windows down in his car so he can hear traffic. So in our be prepared to discuss it, we ask the question of, in order to reasonably raise the issue, does the evidence have to on its face relate to the condition for which you're seeking an extra scheduler rating?
The evidence does have to relate. I have two responses to that, and I recognize that it is under the tenants portion of a hearing loss questionnaire. That is one part of the evidence that we submit reasonably raises the analysis should be done here. Even if it's in, the exam should be read as a whole, it's in the hearing loss examination.
But there was a separate page that dealt with the functional effects of hearing loss itself.
Yes, Your Honor, and the board should have conducted this analysis as well. The board should have conducted the analysis of what the functional effects are and should have answered Your Honor's question in the first instance. I agree that it does slide away a little bit from whether it was reasonably raised in this case, but the other parts of the record do still reasonably raise it toward the analysis.
Even assuming that rolling the windows down is somehow related to the hearing loss as opposed to tinnitus, what would lead us to believe that that itself causes a safety hazard? Is it not a safety precaution here? And are you suggesting that driving with the windows down is inherently dangerous?
Before you answer that, counsel, your time has expired. Could you add 5 minutes? Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. That analysis, again, should have been done by the board. And so answering that at this level of the adjudication is tough, which is why the board's decision should be vacated and the decision remanded. What makes Mr. Morgan's case a little bit stronger, and I admit it's a little bit, it's an analytical step that Your Honor is asking about, and just in all honesty, that's just the way that it can be couched that way. It can be couched as something that's a safety precaution. If you roll your window down today in Washington, D.C., I would submit that's a safety hazard.
But there's nothing in the record that suggests that.
There is not, but the board did recognize that an extra scheduler analysis should be conducted. It undertook it, and then it didn't do anything.
Well, I want to ask that because I have no conception of what the board actually did here. Because it starts out and it says, this is on page 17 of the record, it says, the board has considered whether referral for an extra scheduler rating is warranted, which sounds to me like it recognized that something was raised about it. But then after doing a little bit of discussion, it says, thus the issue has not been raised. So it starts out by saying it's doing the analysis, it does a little bit of it, and then at the end it says it's not raised. What do we do with that?
remand it for more adequate reasons or bases so that we understand what they're talking about. That is part of the problem of this case, and I, Judge Meredith, your question is, of course, a good one that should be done by the board in the first instance. The page before that, Judge Allen, the board basically says, it actually just specifically says, disability ratings for hearing impairment are derived by a mechanical application of audiometric evaluation results to the rating schedule. That's not true. That's only true for the diagnostic criteria. And then on the next page, it just says, yeah, but extra-scheduler wasn't really raised here without any analysis of it. And so that's a reasons or bases problem in this case.
Could I just get back to the other, to the evidence that may have reasonably raised the issue in your view? We talked about the safety issues. You've also argued that there's evidence of marital discord and social isolation. So I think the records that you pointed to, again, were record at 344 from the hearing before the board, where the appellant was asked about the functional impairments caused by his hearing loss, and he says he's asked to turn the TV down, that it impacts his daily life with his spouse, and then he has to ask people to repeat himself. You pointed to record at 436, which reflects, in response to a question about tinnitus, the appellant noted difficulty hearing his grandchildren preacher, and record at 750, which is a disability benefits questionnaire for post-traumatic stress disorder, in which the appellant said that he had a poor relationship with his wife. Where from that do we get social isolation, marital discord at all, but also that it's related to hearing loss?
The last part, the citation to the post-traumatic stress, I'm trying to remember, but that may have been because we argued collective impact, and so that's off the table now because of the Johnson kind of amendment or rewrite of 3.321. But the fact that all of those are not as strong as what was in Mr. King's case, but reasonably raised. For example, I'm using Mr. King's case as an example because it's recent and because that one was pretty obvious because he had the dizziness, he had things that really fell under Doucette. In all honesty, Mr. Morgan's case is not as clean as that, but it meets that low threshold that was described in Comer and Roberson and all of those cases on reasonably raised.
How?
To at least discuss it.
How much do you have to read into this evidence? So if we knock out record at 750, you're left with a question about tinnitus and then one record where he's asked to turn the TV down.
And I don't mean to knock out 750 because that is important to Thun Step 2. Because I didn't mean to just knock it out, because there is, under the hearing loss, part of that particular piece of the record that it does affect his occupation. And so that also reasonably raises some extra scheduler analysis. You have to get to Thun Step 2, which, again,
the issue itself was reasonably raised, and the board had an obligation to discuss it.
But it is lurking out there. And if there's enough to trigger the extra scheduler analysis, which we would say the board's hearing, in which the follow-up questions weren't really asked, in which he said the 10% doesn't cover me, and he starts going down the road of some of the things that it causes him problems with, and the fact that you can read the record broadly, or the board may have been able to read the record broadly enough that there's a safety concern or marital discord. It just never did because it never got to that step in its analysis. The fact that we're talking about it seems like it reasonably raised it. I have to rely on Comer and those types of cases that say it's a very, very low bar, Your Honor.
Mr. Stoltz, doesn't that stretch things just a tad, maybe more than a tad? Safety, marital discord, because he had to ask his wife to turn the TV up or down, and social isolation. I mean, when you look at this record, his hearing loss, all related to, obviously, the ability to not hear as well, but rolling the window down, that's something that people who don't have a hearing loss does from time to time. I think this is a bit of a stretch to try to make the point that all of these should be factored into the... That gets me back to the pool I was talking about. How far down the road are we going on hearing loss? You know, Judge Bartley asked earlier, isn't this really within the normal range of what happens with people who have hearing loss? But
and narrow this court, in my view, is a real stretch.
Those are all factual questions, and it may very well be a stretch to award an extra scheduler evaluation when all is said and done. But the analysis still has to be done by the adjudicator in the first instance. And I would like to, I know that I'm probably sounding a bit like a broken record, but the board's hearing, the Bryant problem in this case, really leads down the road of the fact that none of this analysis was done where it should have been done. And it should have been done by the board, because it did. The board knew well enough that it needed to conduct some type of extra scheduler analysis.
Judge Meredith says, you don't get there unless there's an exceptional picture painted here. And the board said that was not an exceptional picture, as far as I remember the record.
Well, the board just said we took into account the evidence and it's not exceptional, so we're not going to conduct any analysis.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but isn't it just seems to me that the discussion that we're having now, in some measure, is a necessary outgrowth of the court's decision in Doucette. Because once the court included in the list of things that were effects or impacts, or using those different words, that weren't contemplated by the rating schedule, something like social isolation, and said twice in the opinion that this list was non-exhaustive, made that very clear. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of that old saying about the Bedouin and the camel, that the reason you don't let the camel's nose under the tent is because you cannot stop then having a camel in your tent. And it seems to me that once we have opened the door by saying social isolation is something that isn't contemplated and the board has to talk about, it just seems to me that is the fundamental problem here. Because once we do that, then whether or not rolling down a window or having to turn up the TV or when that causes distress is something, it seems to me, is a natural outgrowth of Doucette's majority opinion. And so I know you argued Doucette, and so I know this is an awkward position to put you in, but should Doucette be overruled?
No. No, Your Honor, I don't believe it should be overruled. I don't believe it should be overruled because those are helpful guideposts. There has to be something that has to guide the adjudicators on an extra scheduler analysis.
Does Doucette contain any limiting principle? I mean, is there any limiting factor to the type of analysis that you're advocating?
The limiting factor would be if Mr. Doucette had just had an audiometric hearing, submitted nothing else, had no hearing, there was nothing that said that it affects his occupation, nothing in the record at all, like in Doucette. Doucette itself is limiting because the court in Doucette wrestled with what was in there. There was not enough in there to have warranted an extra scheduler referral. And so the court, by Doucette, explained in that situation, no, this was not board error. And so Doucette, by its own terms, is limiting. But I would continue to say that as far as what analysis... Sorry, Your Honor.
I just added 5 minutes.
Thank you. but I would say that at least the analysis part should be done by the adjudicators in the first instance. And it needs to... It's not as onerous... I want to walk my argument through a little bit more, that it's not as onerous as maybe we're making it sound. Because all that needs to happen is that this fun analysis should be done with an eye towards what the record contains and whether or not that fits under what they alluded to at page 16 in the board's decision, where it just said, nope, only a mechanical application for hearing loss cases. The board should have done a bit more and talked about the fact that he testified as to some symptoms and severity that were outside of the rating schedule, and the fact that Thun Step 2, the kind of the walling off of Thun Step 2 is, in my opinion, a bit unrealistic as set out in Yancey. If the court were going to overturn anything, I think that small part of Yancey that kind of said, look, you do Step 1 and you just put blinders on, Step 1, Step 1, Step 1, Step 1. Okay, there's signs or symptoms that are outside, and now we look to occupation. There is a hearing loss notation that hearing loss affects his occupation, and no one has wrestled with that yet. And it's not up,
this court is not the right forum to wrestle with that, because it's a finding, it's a factual analysis that should be done in the first instance by the board, which is why remand is important here.
Can I ask a question that is a variation of the one that Judge Allen asked? That is, should we overrule Doucette to the extent that it included social isolation in the list of symptoms that should be, that could be contemplated in an extra scheduler setting? Because it, okay, here I'm giving you a push in a certain direction as to the answer that I'm looking for. dizziness, vertigo, ear pain, those are actual symptoms. Social isolation, well, taken in itself, me being a somewhat of an introvert, that's not necessarily a bad thing, social isolation. You know, I may prefer to just sit and read all day and not really go to a party. So, you know, being socially isolated, that's not in itself any kind of disability, whereas the vertigo dizziness thing, there is a DC that covers that whenever people have vertigo, so that those could be called either standalone symptoms or they could be actually secondary conditions, whereas social isolation is like an amorphous. I don't know how to interpret social isolation. I mean, I guess that the prevailing attitude towards it is that it is a negative, but I don't know that that's universally so, and it certainly in itself is not its own disability or symptom. So doesn't it stand out somewhat as having different characteristics than the other things that were included in that parenthetical in Doucette?
It's different than the other things in the parenthetical, but this is a judicial test, and so judicial tests, it's not just extra scheduler. Other courts create judicial tests that they have to wrestle with from time to time. Social isolation is a useful guidepost because, to your honest point, social isolation may not be a negative. It may just be a person's personality. It may be totally fine to sit and read a book, and that's fine. But somebody needs to say that. Somebody needs to say his hearing loss makes him go away for long periods at a time because he doesn't want to interact with people. He gets tired of telling people to say what. But it doesn't affect his occupation. And so there's no extra scheduler. You go to thumb step two. His social isolation doesn't cause him any disability. But the analysis can still be done. It's still a useful analysis.
Judge Bartley's question. Do you think there's a difference between what a symptom is and what a functional effect or impact is? You know, is a functional impact going to be something that you're going to find in a DSM or something like that, or is it something squishier?
Squishy. It's a little squishy. Functional effects serve, and functional effects are talked about, as Judge Boyle and I talked about at the beginning of it. Beginning-ish of the argument, are found in the case law and in the regulation telling the examiners what they need to do. I think that the functional effects do fall under signs and symptoms, but also severity, which is kind of the second component of Thun Step 1. And so it's not real clean, but the functional effects help the adjudicator.
So would social isolation be more of a functional effect or a symptom?
I think it's more of a functional effect usually, I would say. It's more of a functional effect usually. That's my off-the-cuff kind of response to that. But I could see a situation in which that social isolation manifests itself in some severity not contemplated by the diagnostic, or maybe not particularly a symptom, but some severity.
Mr. Stoltz, as far as I recall in the record, there is no indication of any kind of hospitalization or interference with work. Is there a record site that you can provide me?
There is for the work. Interference there is for the work, but not the not the hospitalization. I believe it's record 7. I believe it is record 750, discusses his, and I may, Your Honor, have this. There's a notation that says that he is, I want to give you the exact pinpoint of it. There's a notation under the hearing loss portion of an examination that says, it affects his occupation. I believe it's 434.
Record 434?
Yes, I believe so, Your Honor. Yes. Sorry, Your Honor, it took me a while. But record 434, right in the middle of the page, does the veteran's hearing loss impact ordinary conditions of daily life, including ability to work? Check mark, yes.
Check mark, yes.
Yes.
And that's it. And that your position is this reasonably raises the interference with work part
yes.
of extra schedule.
Yes.
Mr. Stoltz, that's followed by the explanation that people have to talk loud for him to hear.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and that's the evidence that you want to point to that this impacts his ability to work.
That it may impact his ability to work, such that the Thun analysis should have been done in a more robust manner by the adjudicators.
Regarding your claim that there's a Bryant issue, is there additional evidence that could have, would have been submitted?
The answer, under Bryant, this would be going outside of the record, and to answer Your Honor's question, I don't know specifically what Mr. Morgan would be able to submit. I would be happy at the court's order to talk with him about that. But the prejudice under the Bryant analysis and the 3.103 analysis is that there was simply no follow-up or explanation of how he could be getting a higher evaluation than 10%, even though this plain regulation exists. And that's the problem. There's a duty to suggest evidence and to explain the law that the board hearing officer in this case did not do.
Thank you.
Again, let me just go back to my question about Doucette and removing social isolation. What was your answer to that in short?
No. I know you were leaning toward yes, Judge Farley, I know. And there is room. This is a judicial test, and so if it were removed, you know, that happens. I would encourage the court not to remove it because to accord justice, that kind of squishy, high-minded ideal that's in the regulation, social isolation may be something in some veterans' cases that could lead to severe signs or symptoms outside of the diagnostic criteria. That's why I would encourage the court not to. I do recognize that my answer is yes to Your Honor's question of whether social isolation is different than the other mm-hmm. symptoms that are discussed in Doucette. In all fairness, it is different. It is a harder concept.
And to the question whether that the inclusion there has led us down a road of never-ending, you know, it requiring the board and the RO perhaps to look at complaints of I have to do this because I have hearing loss, I have to do that because I have hearing loss, it causes strain, it causes stress, it looking at aspects of the veteran's life that although 4.10 requires that those be discussed in an examination report, they are not typically things, correct me if I'm wrong, that are generally serve as the basis for an evaluation under the rating schedule.
Correct. Yes, Your Honor. I agree with Your Honor. Under the rating schedule.
Yes, under the rating schedule.
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't misspeak. Yeah.
Right. Yes, I agree with
okay.
Your Honor.
Okay. And but your view is that they should be included somehow in an extra, there should be an analysis of them whenever they are mentioned or reasonably raised in the record, there should be an analysis of whether they require VA to refer for an extra scheduler eval.
Yes, because I believe Thun would control that scenario, and Thun talks, Thun and its progeny talk about the things, those functional effects maybe being outside of it. If the functional effects...
I mean, didn't Thun just use symptoms? It didn't, in symptomatology, did it refer at all to functional effects?
The cases that came after talked okay. about the severity.
Okay.
Which...
Would you agree with me, though, that the inclusion of that term and functional effects like social isolation, such as marital discord or disharmony in the family or traffic safety impacts from disability, would you agree with me that their inclusion seems to open a door to a never-ending stream of aspects that have not generally even been included in extra scheduler evals?
It opens the door. I will agree with Your Honor that it opens the door. I would respectfully disagree that it's never ending. And once the board offered, the board and the regional offices exist to help veterans flesh out what their disability picture, to borrow the term from, I think, 4.1, and from 3.321, what the disability picture is. And so asking some follow-up questions and taking the veteran's, you know, overall condition into account doesn't have to be that onerous. It is more work. It is more work for the adjudicators to have to run through the extra scheduler analysis. But the regulation exists.
Uh-huh. Right, but we're trying to figure out what the regulation
right.
entails.
Yeah.
So, under Doucette, if it were applied if the same notion of extra scheduler evaluations were applied to physical disabilities, you could have a veteran arguing, could you not, that some kind of musculoskeletal condition, let's say a knee or an ankle condition, created a functional impairment of a driving safety impact. And that is fine with you. That's the way the extra scheduler regulation was meant to be interpreted.
Well, it would be done under step one, and it may not go anywhere. The analysis may not go anywhere, because if it causes problems, Mr. Morgan happened to be a truck driver. And so if there are effects on his ability to drive, then that goes to Thun step two. If what Your Honor is proposing is just that's the effect, but it doesn't cause any effect on occupation, then that's the end of the analysis, and perhaps that's where the door slams shut, so that it's not necessarily never ending. Because you do still have the second part of Thun. And so if it doesn't cause any effect on employment, there's no reason to award an extra scheduler evaluation or indeed a higher diagnostic criteria or a higher scheduler, because the whole point is to, as Your Honor knows, is to compensate for loss of occupational function.
Okay. Counsel, your time has expired several times.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Morris, you will have 25 additional minutes should you need it.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Your Honors, entitlement to an extra scheduler evaluation is not a question that should come up in most or even many cases. It's not an alternative path to compensation. It's not a theory of entitlement. It's a last resort. An equitable stopgap that applies only in the rare instances where the system designed to rate disabilities is inadequate. Your Honors, when we're looking at an extra scheduler, whether it's for purposes of determining whether it's raised or whether it's warranted, we're looking at several things. First, Your Honors, we're looking to determine whether the diagnostic criteria of the corresponding or the analogous diagnostic code fairly approximate the level of disability. And to do that, we're looking, Your Honors, to whether the disability is unusual or exceptional, and if so, whether it's so unusual and so exceptional that we can't practically apply the regular scheduler standards. And then, Your Honor, we're looking to determine whether those unusual or exceptional features of the disability sufficiently impact the veteran's ability to work. So we're looking at things like marked interference with employment and frequent periods of hospitalization. And only then, Your Honor, do we get to the actual question, which is whether the veteran's schedule evaluation is actually inadequate. And we're comparing, then, the average impairment in earning capacity caused by the veteran's disability with the average impairment in earning capacity represented and reflected in the diagnostic code. And, Your Honor, before I address the court's questions, I'd like to identify five points of discussion that I believe are go to the heart of the court's questions, but are also critical to understanding and properly applying 3.321b1 and any framework for extra scheduler analysis. And the first, Your Honor, goes to the scope and the adequacy of the rating schedule, because we can't talk about extra scheduler without first talking about the rating schedule itself. Second, Your Honor, is how the diagnostic criteria work. And the third, Your Honor, is what makes a disability unusual or exceptional. And the fourth is what evidence or type of evidence is needed to show that a disability is unusual or exceptional. And then finally, Your Honor, where does the burden of proof in all of this lie? Your Honors, I'd like to begin by noting that, again, disability compensation is based on average impairment in earning capacity, which looks not to the individual circumstances of a veteran, but to the impairment of function and how that impairment would, on average, negatively impact earning capacity. The rating schedule recognizes hundreds and hundreds of disabilities, and it is regularly revised, updated, and expanded. As this court has recognized, it is adequate to rate a disability in all but rare and exceptional cases. By definition, most cases can't be rare and exceptional, because mathematically, it's improbable that a disability won't be adequately rated under the schedule. And, Your Honor, I believe that has to be the starting point to any discussion. And it has to be the starting point to any discussion about extra scheduler, because any other view that turns extra scheduler into a regular consideration is clearly and plainly inconsistent with those principles and with the regulation itself. So I'd then like to begin with the diagnostic criteria. Your Honor, the diagnostic criteria of the diagnostic codes, they serve as a proxy to generalize average impairment in earning capacity. And they do this, the diagnostic criteria are simply standardized variables. They're standardized variables chosen by the Secretary to approximate disability level. They're variables that allow inferences and generalizations to be drawn about the nature and severity of a disability. And they may be, those variables may be the presence or absence of certain specified symptoms. They may be the results of objective tests or clinical tests or audiology tests. They may be different levels of severity of a certain specified symptom or any other metric that the Secretary has chosen as the best way to infer and make generalizations about disability level. And because of that, Your Honor, the diagnostic criteria, the diagnostic codes are not meant to paint these all-encompassing pictures of disabilities by listing every sign or symptom of that disability. Because again, Your Honor, these are approximators. These are variables that the Secretary has chosen. And this is well reflected in many of the Federal Register publications that have come along with revisions made to the diagnostic code, up to and including the hearing loss. And there is a reason that the Secretary has chosen audiometric tests, pure tone thresholds, and speech recognition tests, because those are tests that are universally recognized to provide accurate and insightful information about the level of a hearing loss disability. Your Honor, when counsel has discussed and when this court has discussed these effects, such as rolling down the window, turning up the television, having somebody repeat themselves, Your Honor, that is nothing more than evidence of the existence of a disability or its severity. We know there is a disability. And as to the severity, the Secretary has chosen to measure and approximate this, to measure the severity of that disability by audiometric test results. Yes, Your Honors, the Secretary could have chosen alternative variables, such as how loud do you have to turn a television on, or how many times do people have to repeat yourselves. But you can see why that would be inaccurate, because it begs the questions, how far is your TV? How loud is your spouse? And that would affect, you know, these the use of these variables to assess severity level. So again, simply pointing to these pieces of evidence does nothing. And to suggest that they would overcome the results reached by application of the Secretary's chosen variables is simply inconsistent with the diagnostic codes, but also intrudes into what this Court has recognized is an area that this Court does not have review over, which is precisely how the Secretary has chosen to measure what variables he's chosen.
I can interject.
Yes, sir.
Assuming what you say is accurate, how does that reconcile with the Secretary's regulation 4.10 that tells doctors to assess a full description of the effects on the person's ability to do ordinary activity? If all you care about is the pure tone threshold levels in a lab test, why do you ask a doctor to make this inquiry?
Your Honor, there are several reasons. I mean, one, we do want a full picture of a disability. But there are different...
And what are you going to do with that?
But different diagnostic codes use different metrics, Your Honor. And some of those metrics may be certain indicators of functional impairments or the actual impairment of function of that particular body.
But that would be listed in the diagnostic code. You wouldn't need to remind a doctor to do that separately.
But we wouldn't necessarily have the information because there are diagnostic codes that again, the variables range between, again, the presence or absence of symptoms up to and including certain functional impairments if specified by the diagnostic code, up to and including any other variable, whether they currently exist or they're conceivably could be used in the future to rate a disability. So again, getting a full picture of a disability, Your Honor, I don't believe is inconsistent with the Secretary's position, but it also doesn't make rating the disability or it doesn't change the nature of the diagnostic codes. Because again, Your Honor, this is reflected in the diagnostic codes themselves. First, the mere fact that the diagnostic codes clearly do not all paint, or even attempt to paint pictures of the disability itself, because they do use very different variables. But again, also underlying the revisions made, now some of these codes have existed long before.
I'm sorry, I still don't understand what you believe the VA adjudicator is supposed to do with this information in a diagnostic code that has very objective criteria like hearing loss or range of motion.
Your Honor, medical examiners are also told to capture things like other parts of history, social history, military history, which have zero relevance to the rating of a disability and very often have, you know, limited relevance to whether service connection would be granted. There's a lot of information that's obtained, and it's better to obtain more information to determine whether it might be useful in the future than not to obtain it the first time. Because, again, sending a veteran back for another examination if one doesn't have the information that ultimately is useful would be both delay the adjudication of a veteran's claim, but it would also be wasteful of resources, you know, and money. So I don't believe, Your Honor, that it is indicative of how we necessarily rate every disability, the fact that we may ask for, certain effects. What is critical, though, is understanding the impairment and function of the injured or diseased body part, system, or organ of the body. That is ultimately...
Maybe this is exactly Judge Shova's question, so I'll...
And hopefully you'll ask it better.
Try. I'm not optimistic. So, in my ability. But, Mr. Morris, so let's try it from the back end, right? Because I also don't understand why one in the hearing loss context would ask for functional effects on your argument. So let's go to the other way to ask the question and say what would make a hearing loss disability exceptional in your view under 3.321 if it isn't the functional effects the hearing exam or the examiner captures?
I need to qualify the question. If the disability is a hearing loss disability, I don't know that anything would necessarily make it unusual or exceptional, because we do have to remember that
let me just stop that, because it seems if that's right, and maybe it's right, I'm not to the right or wrong, I hope so, but that would lead us to overrule a number of cases, right? I mean, and it's okay, we're on bonk, and hopefully we're on bonk for a reason, but that is entirely inconsistent with Doucette. It's entirely inconsistent with Martinek, in fact. Andrews, or not Andrews, yes. Is that what you're asking for? Because, and that's okay if you are, but I want to make that really clear.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that there are a number of assumptions that this court has made, starting with its earlier cases, and that it has expanded those assumptions over time to a point where case law is no longer consistent with the underlying regulation, but more so is inconsistent with the way that disabilities are evaluated under the rating schedule. So I believe that there are aspects of many of these cases that this court should revisit and reconsider. I don't know if it requires a wholesale overruling of
that. Well, but how could it not? I just want to try to figure out what the position is, right? Because if the Secretary's position is, listen, given the diagnostic code as it exists for hearing loss, there simply is no room for extra scheduler analysis.
If I may finish the thought on that, though, I don't believe that there's no room for an extra scheduler analysis. I cannot think of a disability that we couldn't potentially rate analogously under a different diagnostic code. And taking even, for example, the dizziness or the loss of balance, and assuming that it is part of some condition that also results in hearing loss. We do have other diagnostic codes, up to and including Meniere's disease, and so perhaps that would be the analogous diagnostic code that we should use. We shouldn't simply be looking at a different diagnostic code and then correcting some error that existed in the application of the rating schedule. And beyond that, the other matters that the court has noted in Doucette, and assuming for a moment that you know, social isolation or these other effects, the court also appears to have overlooked that, again, those are not without the ability to rate, because if they were caused by a hearing loss disability, then that indicates the potential for a secondary disability, and that's the matter that needs to be considered. And there are diagnostic codes. If it is part of a secondary disability, then we look to see what that disability is, and that disability could potentially be rated. Alternatively, if it is, I will note just for the sake of noting that hearing loss, the veteran in Doucette was service-connected for bilateral hearing loss. Bilateral hearing loss simply does not cause dizziness. Dizziness may be indicative of an underlying disability, but again, the veteran in that case didn't have it. So again, I believe that the court simply made assumptions, medical assumptions, that certain things could be related to this hearing loss. If the problem was in the way that service connection was granted, then that's an issue that is not corrected through an extra scheduler evaluation. That's an issue that needs to be addressed elsewhere. Because perhaps if these things are all true and these things are all caused by it, then the veteran may actually have a different disability. But again, he had bilateral hearing loss, and bilateral hearing loss is properly and adequately rated under the diagnostic code for measuring the loss of hearing acuity.
I actually tend to agree with you that a lot of things could be rated secondarily service-connected, but that only addresses one part of the THUN test. It doesn't address the severity part, and I know we were talking functional impairment before, but you drifted off into the sentence. So how do you deal with, because the only instances I have ever seen VA award extra scheduler is in the severity context, So would you say there are diagnostic codes that are, as I asked Mr. Stoltz, off the table for extra scheduler, because how do I know what Roman numeral 4 means in a diagnostic code for hearing loss, or what hypertension, blood pressure level X should be resulting in, can you run across the street or not?
With due respect, if what Your Honor is looking at is merely evidence of severity, again, that is simply evidence of severity that is going up and challenging the level of severity that was found by the board given the audiometric tests. That is not a matter for extra scheduler consideration or any other consideration. If a veteran says, I cannot hear anybody, no matter how loud they are, yet audiometric tests reveal that he has a 10% evaluation, what that is a challenge to the variables, to the standards that the Secretary has chosen to use to measure hearing loss.
So when does severity come into play?
I don't believe that it typically would come into play. If we're looking at diagnostic codes that indicate symptoms, unless a diagnostic code is specifically limiting the severity of that symptom or grading the severity of that symptom, saying mildly severe, moderately severe, nothing, and then super extremely severe, then...
So you think that THUN using severity as one of its touchstones is wrong and should be overruled?
I do. I don't think it's wrong in every case because, again, there are situations where a certain level of severity may not, you know, be contemplated. Again, if the code simply refers to certain symptoms and like, if they only present as mild, then there's, and again, we do have an unusual disability picture, like exhibiting severity that is beyond that and that is recognized as being unusual, then perhaps severity would come into play. So it's not.
So absolutely. I'm sorry. Are you saying if it's like a maxed out diagnostic code, or
I can't actually think of a diagnostic code right now off the top of my head where it would apply. I'm not saying I don't think it applies typically. And again, typically, where a diagnostic code uses a symptom as a metric. I mean, I believe that even this court has recognized in Bankhead that it doesn't differentiate between the levels of severity. If a disability rating can't go down because a variable listed is less severe, then it follows that it also wouldn't go up. But the secretary has chosen that variable in all levels of severity. So I don't believe that severity is typically going to be relevant to the Thun analysis. What's relevant to the Thun analysis is whether the disabling condition presents with unusual or exceptional signs and symptoms. And that's the first part of the relevant analysis, because if it does, it may increase the likelihood that we're wrong to assume that the diagnostic code fairly approximates disability.
Back you up a step.
Yes.
So in your initial pleadings, you argued that the issue of extra scheduler consideration was not reasonably raised or explicitly raised below, so the board had no obligation to consider it. Is that still your position?
Yes, Your Honor. I will caveat it with the fact that obviously we were operating under, you know, the current law and not in front of an en banc panel right now. So, I mean, there are at least certain points to clarify, but no, in this case, it is still our position that it wasn't raised at all. I believe that part of why the board does address this is because I do think that case law has pushed the board into that corner of addressing it in every case, lest it faces a remand to simply determine whether something has been raised in the first instance. Because I do believe that it is the current trend in case law to simply look at the record, note that there are signs, symptoms, or any downstream or collateral effect of a disability, and put the onus on the board to explain why that is not indicative of an unusual or exceptional disability picture. And I don't believe that that's correct, Your Honor. We believe that foremost, downstream collateral effects are not relevant to whether a disability is unusual or exceptional. At most, most of these simply indicate individual circumstances, the very thing that we don't consider when rating a disability at all. But beyond that, what we're looking for, again, is the underlying condition. Is that unusual? Is that exceptional? Or is that something that the rating code, using the variables that are in it, is going to fairly approximate the disability level of? And what we need in these cases, and what's often missing, and what I do believe was lacking in cases like Doucette, and I believe in King, is even a connection. Even if we assume that we just limit it to the signs and symptoms, these records were devoid of any evidence connecting those signs and symptoms to the underlying condition, let alone any evidence even remotely suggesting that they may actually be unusual or exceptional. So again, the onus was put onto the board to effectively prove a negative. Board, prove why the Secretary's system for rating disabilities doesn't work. Board, prove why these are not unusual or exceptional manifestations of a disability when there is not even a scintilla of evidence to suggest that they are part of that underlying condition, or even might be unusual or exceptional.
Can I jump in, though?
Yep.
If the issue wasn't reasonably raised, the board had no obligation to discuss extra scheduler. So would any error in their discussion of it be non-prejudicial?
Yes, I think that there have been certain like graded levels of reasonably raised, because one can reasonably raise the idea of simply simply dismissing it at risk of otherwise having inadequate R&B because it's unclear whether the board considered whether it was reasonably raised, and I think that is one of the extremes. But beyond that, it's not simply the issue of extra scheduler, because even the components of it, there needs to be something that reasonably raises the prospect that signs or symptoms allegedly identified in the record are actually a part of this underlying condition. And I stress that because, again, Your Honors, if it's not a part of that underlying condition, if it is a separate condition related to the underlying injury or disease, then we have the prospect of separate ratings. If it is entirely unrelated to that underlying condition, or, you know, then it's not subject to compensation. And if it is indicative of a separate disability caused by the original disability, then again, we are not in the context of rating this disability. We are in the context of determining secondary service connection. So it's critical. Again, extra scheduler is a last resort. And in fact, Your Honors, I would submit to you that it's not even the most beneficial way for a veteran to obtain compensation for any of these other disabilities. And the more we lump into this extra scheduler analysis, the less favorable it is to a veteran. Because if a veteran is experiencing a separate disability, then secondary service connection would probably be more favorable to that veteran. If a veteran has a separate disability that resulted from the same underlying injury or condition, then perhaps it's better to have a separate rating, because this is only the very first part of any analysis as to an extra scheduler evaluation, because the ultimate analysis, again, is simply based on, is the average impairment in earning capacity caused by the veteran's disability greater than the average impairment in earning capacity reflected in the diagnostic code? And even within that, the veteran would still need to get past that second, which is, again, sufficient impairment on that veteran's ability to work. So marked interference or frequent periods of hospitalization. So putting all of this on the board to explain why something doesn't fit into the rating schedule, the rating of this particular disability, at the exclusion of everything else that the rating schedule contemplates and allows for, including assignment of separate ratings, secondary service connection, Your Honors, we don't believe that is what this regulation intended. Again, this regulation was meant to apply when nothing else does.
Could I get back to the specific evidence in this case that you've recently raised? So as we were talking about with the appellant's counsel, some of the evidence that they pointed to as reasonably raising this issue actually on its face dealt with either PTSD or tinnitus. Can you give us the Secretary's position on whether evidence that on its face relates to a different disability could reasonably raise the issue of hearing loss extra scheduler?
No, Your Honor, because I don't think it would be unreasonable to not see it as not being reasonably raised.
And on the issue of social isolation and marital discord, there was a discussion about the evidence of turning down the TV and not being able to hear the preacher. Is there anything in your view in the record that raises those as conditions or effects of hearing loss?
No, Your Honor, but again, it's still more fundamentally our position that they wouldn't be relevant to an extra scheduler analysis regardless, that social isolation is not the result of any loss of function of the ear or the auditory system. It is not a part, it cannot be a part of that condition. Now, the caveat to that would be, unless there was medical evidence in the record that suggested it, which I would submit to you is impossible, but again, I'm not suggesting that we would overcome evidence in the record if it did actually say that the rupture in a veteran's eardrum has led to, and again, not social isolation, but perhaps that is indicative of some other symptom. But so in any case, regardless of whether social isolation was raised, and we don't believe that the idea of social isolation was raised, even if it was, it still would not be relevant to an extra scheduler analysis of whether the idea of whether the diagnostic code fairly approximated the veteran's disability level, it wouldn't undermine or undercut.
Can you clarify for me exactly what you would like the court to do, not so much in this particular fact pattern, but as you said, we're en banc. You seem to have some ideas that what we've done in the past isn't accurate and we should do something different.
I believe that what the court should do is go back to the fundamental principles, not only that it recognized, in Thun, but also in the external law outside of Thun, that the court should recognize that the proper framework should start with whether the diagnostic criteria of a corresponding or analogous diagnostic code fairly approximate disability level, based on a recognition that the criteria are standardized variables, not intended to paint a complete picture of a disability, but to approximate disability level. And within that, we'd be looking, that's where we're looking to determine whether a disability is unusual or exceptional, and then, if so, whether it's so unusual, so exceptional, that it renders the application of the standards inadequate. Then, Your Honors, whether those unusual or exceptional features cause sufficient impairment in the ability to work, so marked interference with employment or frequent periods of hospitalization. Because at that point, that is when we might guess that maybe there is a chance that this veteran is inadequately rated, and maybe justice will require the actual analysis, which is, again, the comparison of the average impairment in earning capacity caused by the veteran's disability compared to what's represented by the schedule evaluation.
Do we have to overrule any of our cases to do this?
I believe that it would have to overrule at least portions of this court's case law. I don't believe, though, that it is inconsistent with, again, the principles that the court recognized in Thun, the idea that this is based on average, the idea that individual circumstances don't matter. But I also believe, Your Honor, that there are inconsistencies that currently exist in this extra scheduler sphere, which are inconsistent with other cases by this court. And one of those does have to do with the burden of proof. Because, again, many of these cases rely on mere assumptions and speculations that two things might be related, that one thing might be unusual. But, again, Your Honor, the burden of proof is always on a claimant to demonstrate his or her entitlement to benefits. And it is a record that is relevant in a case, and not supposition and not assumptions. And the court has recognized as much in plenty of other cases. So while I do think that cases would need to be overruled, I don't know that overruling them would be inconsistent with the general framework that exists governing the rest of the law. And again, I do think that most fundamental in all of this, again, is the recognition of what the diagnostic criteria are meant to do, and the recognition that it should not be put onto the board to prove a negative when there is no evidence that indicates the positive.
Mr. Morris. Yes. Let's assume that we accept your position regarding the case law previous to Morgan, and that in attempting to construct a better approach of our jurisprudence, we talk a little bit about King and Doucette and Martinet and all the cases that preceded this one, and indicate that while we may not be inclined to overrule, we may clarify the direction of this assessment, this analysis, and in doing so, we come up with a test that focuses more on basically the regulatory language that you're really talking about. And I'll quote it. The governing norm in these exceptional cases is a finding by the director that application of the regular scheduler standards is impractical because the disability is so exceptional or unusual due to such related factors as marked interference with employment or frequent periods of hospitalization. Let's suppose that that becomes the focal point for this court's analysis, and moving forward, that's the test that we adopt. Would that satisfy your concerns about this area?
To some extent, Your Honor, because I still believe that the ultimate analysis, that these things may be governing norms, but the ultimate analysis, again, is a finding that the average impairment in earning capacity caused by the veteran's disability is less than what's reflected in the scheduler evaluation, because the extra scheduler evaluation is only assigned commensurate with the average impairment in earning capacity. So I think that still is the overarching governing rule here. And part of it is just to get to that point, to determine whether, you know, that scheduler evaluation first may be inadequate, again, is where we're first looking to the diagnostic criteria. We're looking to the diagnostic code. We're looking to the rating schedule. We're looking to see whether there's other ways that a veteran could be rated, whether there's separate disabilities. And these are issues that, again, Your Honor, these should be, you know, addressed in the appropriate forum. So I do agree that looking at the governing norm should be a central focus, but I don't believe that the court should lose sight of the overarching overarching principles and overarching rules, Your Honor. And I think that largely in our view, I mean, one, again, I do think it's critical to understand, you know, the Secretary's intention behind the diagnostic criteria. And I think that most recently that was, I think, the divergence between what we believe, even what FUN stood for, and current case law is reflected most recently in King, which simply look at what's in the record and look at what's in the diagnostic, you know, criteria. And I don't believe that that would ever be compatible with the system, with what extra scheduler is, because it's also not compatible with what the rating schedule is.
So this leads me to a question. You seem to, in response to one of Judge Meredith's questions earlier, you seem to have a different view of Thun Step 1. Go over what you think like an optimum Thun Step 1 would be, assuming that prior to getting there, an adjudicator or the board had already gone through the process of looking for a whether secondary service connection could be granted or should be developed with regard to a particular symptom or set of symptoms. So what if they've done that? They say, now, you know, this is not susceptible to secondary service connection. So they have some symptoms that the veteran experiences that are not susceptible to secondary service connection, but that are not covered under the schedule. What happens?
Well, I think part of that would depend on why they're not covered by a secondary service connection. Obviously, if they're not related, then I think then that would take remove us from everything. If it was because it simply didn't rise to the level of a disability, I mean, I think that also, or that it wasn't actually any form of, you know, of disabling event, we'll call it, then I don't know that it would be relevant either. And, Your Honor, again, like, this extra scheduler, we get here, I mean, really when nothing else works. And to note, or to emphasize even, we don't compensate for symptoms. I mean, that's not the way the disability that the disability system works. We don't simply just take every symptom and take each symptom individually. We're compensating for the overall impairment in function and how that, on average, translates to impairment in earning capacity. And as much as we're not taking into account, like, individual circumstances, like what must this veteran do because of XYZ of his disability, again, certain symptoms, they're assumed. They're a part of the disability, you know, a disability picture itself, which again is what the diagnostic codes, the diagnostic criteria, whether corresponding or analogous, and again that's something that I think is often overlooked, is that this court has even recognized that between corresponding and analogous diagnostic codes, the rating schedule is typically going to be accurate, that again, rare and exceptional circumstances. So I do think that yes, if there is a sign or symptom, there would still need to be evidence that sign or symptom is a part of the underlying disability. It's not simply by process of elimination that, well, it's not secondary, right? You would need the evidence. And the only way that you'd actually eliminate the second possibility, which is entirely it's unrelated, would be with positive evidence relating it to the original underlying condition.
Yep, so let's say you went through those mm-hmm. steps. Yes. Whenever I think of a, and some judges here are sick of hearing me talk about this case, but Artisan, It was an early extra scheduler case where the veteran had tinea pedis or athlete's foot, and it was not only like blisters or whatever and sweaty feet and stuff. It was like smelling, so that people every few hours he had to change his socks and smells would emanate from his cubicle, so people didn't want to work with him. Okay, so let's say you actually have a legitimate case like that where you've tried to get secondaries, you know, secondary doesn't work out. This cluster of symptoms is not, it would be hard to fit into another corresponding or analogous DC, and it's also related to the condition. There's no question about any of that. What should VA do? How does 3.321 work to that?
The next step still is to determine whether, again, assuming all these facts, that this is an actual actually unusual or exceptional for this underlying foot condition to have all of these symptoms associated with it. And the next step is to look to see whether it's so unusual that it renders the schedule standards or the regular standards impractical. And I know
and that so Thune says that to do that you compare it to the DC. What would you suggest in the alternative if you're suggesting an alternative?
I believe the first thing that Thune said was that we determine whether the rating is actually inadequate simply by comparing these two things. And, Your Honor, I don't believe that's logically tenable, that it doesn't demonstrate that something is inadequate. I do believe that there has to be not a direct comparison, but, again, the theoretical underpinning to that, which is kind of, are these criteria at a fair approximators of disability level? But the next thing that we do look to, Your Honor, which I do believe is potentially overlooked and done, is, again, is the rating schedule still, like, can we still not apply these schedule standards? Because I would note that, one, the rating schedule is constantly updated and expanded. And so the more it's expanded, the more it's going to cover. And it's not to say that the Secretary couldn't cover exceptional disabilities. And, in fact, he has to one degree with exceptional patterns of hearing loss. So we still do want to ensure that we can't adequately, you know, that we can't cover this and that it's not covered, even if it's unusual. And so if those conditions are met, then, again, we're not going to necessarily assume that the diagnostic criteria, that the diagnostic code is fairly approximating disability level. So then we do want to see whether to move on in the analysis, and that's where things like marked interference with employment come to, and that's why we focus on the individual veteran, because, as co-counsel noted, this is ultimately to accord justice in these exceptional cases. So we do want to ensure that this particular veteran is actually experiencing an impairment in order to move on to that final analysis, which is by regulation undertaken by the director, which is this comparison of average impairment in other capacity.
Mr. Morris, does record at 434 make the point for this particular veteran about impairing employment? Take a moment. Take a look at it.
It does not. In no way does it implicate anything regarding an ability to work. And again, Your Honor, it reflects nothing more than the existence of what we know, which is that there's a disability. Your Honors, before I sit, I just wanted to make sure that I did actually address the many things that I came up here prepared to talk about. I think I might have.
Let me just have you reiterate. You do or don't find viable the first step of Thune?
I think the intent behind Thune is accurate. I think the idea of Thune, which is to recognize those cases which are good candidates for further consideration, I think that's viable. I do not agree with the way that it is framed or phrased specifically. I think that it can be clarified, but I also believe that it should include what the Secretary has submitted should be these kind of middle, these middle pieces to the puzzle, and that it should not be viewed as this mere comparison. Again, the idea between,
I understand your conceptual discussions, and yes. I like conceptual discussions, but somebody up here, or maybe more than one of us, is literally going to have to sit at a computer and type something.
Yes.
So, as I understand Judge Bartley's question, if you don't like the way that the first step in Thune yes. is framed, how would you like that to be framed?
Do the diagnostic criteria provide a fair approximation of disability level? And that first question would be comprised of two sub-questions, which is, does the disabling condition present with unusual or exceptional signs or symptoms? And if so, are those signs or symptoms so unusual or so exceptional that application of the scheduler standards is impractical? That would be the first step if we're making it analogous to what Thun indicated. And again, even clarifying that second step, we're looking for that sufficient impairment in the veteran's ability to work, and that's where marked interference with employment comes from in frequent periods of hospitalization. So, Your Honors, in conclusion, maybe not. But in conclusion, Your Honors, I do believe that this court should reconsider certain of the assumptions that it has and how those assumptions have grown, that the court should revert back to the underlying regulation, which is what it has been attempting to interpret. But it should not simply look at the regulation, but it should look at the entire rating system around it, which is Part 4, and what Part 4 permits. Because every time the regulation is expanded, an extra scheduler is expanded, we're effectively narrowing the rating schedule, because we're pushing back against it, saying that it is becoming more and more inadequate. And I don't believe that that's appropriate. So, Your Honors, I will leave you with simply this, that if we think about extra scheduler evaluation, if we think about the rating schedule as simply a highway, it is a highway that everybody gets on. There's an emergency service road, but you don't get onto it. You don't get onto that unless you actually have an emergency. So, no, it's not parallel paths. It's not two paths that everybody gets to take to see what leads them the furthest. You stay on one, and it's in the emergency situations where that one doesn't work that we may get you onto the other. So, thank you,
Your Honor. I think runaway truck ramp would be a better...
I will leave you with this, because I do know that we did say, we did make a lot of points, and I don't know how coherent I was in much or if any of it. We would be happy to submit this particular, position to you, in writing, if it would help, Your Honors, just so that we could actually pinpoint, the way that we, that we believe that it should be done. And if Your Honors would permit us or both parties, 7 days, we can have something to you.
So. Sounds like it could be helpful, Counsel. Thank you.
It seems, in listening to the Secretary's presentation today, that the Secretary is almost getting to the award of an extra scheduler rating before he's getting to what is owed by the adjudicator to determine what the overall disability picture is for a veteran. Mr. Morgan, Mr. King, Mr. Peterman did not ask the Secretary to prove a negative. That is not what happens in an extra scheduler analysis under Thun. Under Thun, it is all an adjudication. And my opposing counsel is exactly right. The appellant bears the burden. But he bears the burden in a system that is supposed to be helpful to the veteran. When he got to the Board of Veterans' Appeals in this particular case, and a little bit to Judge Meredith's point, that could it have been more clearly raised by the record? The answer to that is yes. It could have been more like King. But he does, at page 344, for the first time that he is in a non-adversarial process with a lawyer from VA asking him questions, says, I'm paraphrasing a bit, but it's at page 344, it's my contention that a 10% evaluation is not sufficient. There's one or two follow-up questions to that, and that is it. The point of this, not to belabor the Bryant argument found in our pleadings, the point of this is to show that the Board of Veterans' Appeals and regional offices are equipped to undertake the analysis laid out in Thun and explained in the subsequent case law. Each individual case will present the adjudicators with different circumstances, and some of them may be challenging. But that doesn't mean that the good and well-intentioned regulation 3.321, which is supposed to take an individual into account, should be written out. The Secretary said that the rating schedule changes and that the rating schedule works most of the time. Again, paraphrasing, and I hope that I'm getting that right. We don't disagree. Mr. Morgan doesn't disagree that the rating schedule works. I may personally disagree that the rating schedule changes a lot. It does, but perhaps not a lot. But it does. The entire idea of extra schedule is that a human being, that the human veteran, presents each time with a unique picture. It doesn't mean that an extra schedule evaluation needs to be awarded every time. But the rating specialists and the board hearing officers and the veterans law judges and everybody else involved in this process should at least
go down the road of whether or not there is something else we can do for this veteran when he is saying that the evaluation is not sufficient, in my opinion. That is all Mr. Morgan is asking. And the way to do that, this court has articulated very well in Thun and its progeny, and following step one and step two together, does get the adjudicator to a point where they can at least reasonably compensate a veteran for the loss of earning capacity. And if the diagnostic code doesn't quite cut it for that individual veteran, it gives VA the chance to make this veteran as whole as possible. If there are no further questions, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you all. The case is submitted for consideration. The court will now come down and meet counsel and resume for our ceremonial session in 2 minutes.